Good morning and welcome to Conversations, a show on WDRT, where a series of interviewers discusses topics with a series of interviewees. This morning, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Mr. Jerome McGeorge, a man who wears many hats in the community. Welcome, Jerome.
Well, thank you, Eddie, and pleased to be with this audience.
It's an awesome responsibility to be Jerome. Why don't you just start off by telling us a little bit about your childhood?
Well, there's two big stories in my childhood. One, contracting polio at 7 in 1948. And I was paralyzed for a few months in a children's memorial hospital, and that I once was released from the hospital, which was a life-changing experience into my inner mind, my inner life, in that I was alone in a hospital room and there was no television, there was no radio, and we never left bed. Now, I had a recovery with a lot of love from my mother, my family, and interestingly, I developed a passion for pole vaulting, which was an unconscious, boyish decision, and yet was an intuitive physical therapy for someone learning to walk and then run again. And it became an obsessive passion. Certainly, I have wonderful memories of my passion for pole vaulting. In the recovery period and becoming a well-rewarded pole vaulter, my father died when I was 12. He, 39, mother, widowed with the three of us, me being the eldest. And, of course, both of those happenings in boyhood were occasions for grief, occasions for lack of understanding coming to insightful understandings. And so I look back on these events of my boyhood and I'm grateful. I had a very strengthening boyhood, particularly for the two events I just referenced, and the lessons learned have benefited me now at 84 in 2025. I have a lot to be grateful for.
Indeed, indeed. Moving into your young adulthood or early adulthood, did you attend college? And when was this?
This, of course, was in the 60s. I first began college in my freshman year in 1959. College was a disappointment to someone who had real scholarly ambition, and by that I mean wanting to be uplifted and to be stimulated and to be excited about learning, and certainly I was afforded such occasions, and yet I was also afforded many boring classroom experiences. And so I didn't take a degree until I was 24, as I kept dropping out each time earlier than the last. Early adulthood, and the astrologer in me wants to introduce the generic Saturn return phenomenon. And the Saturn return astrological theory says that until Saturn returns to its original birth, or what we call our natal position, that we are developing human beings, and even modern definitions of adulthood, typically these days beginning at 18 with voting rights, other adult freedoms and responsibilities. However, at 18, we have not had the developmental experiences of work and money and career, nor have we begun the parenting adventure for those of us who were to become parents. So that at a first Saturn return at 29, we end a development period in our life cycle, and from 29 until approximately 58, we are in adult powers. We are the ones carrying the world, raising children, having careers, and fulfilling all the functions that are necessary in a society. I also, having now approaching the third Saturn return, I advise people 58, 59, 60, you're a baby old person. I identify as a very experienced old guy.
So after college, you ended up making your way to New York City to work in a very interesting field, which was the oil companies. Tell us about how you found your way there.
Maybe not a straight line path. Certainly, as in my early fathering, I had the mistaken opinion that I couldn't be a serious father if I didn't have a degree. So with much greater will, I returned and received a degree, and subsequently hired on to the Sinclair Oil Corporation in Chicago, Illinois. 6 months later, figures from world headquarters in New York, Sinclair being a world oil and energy company, that I accepted the transfer and spent 3 years until 1970 in an oil company financial career. My wife, the mother of my children, accused me of being a hypocrite in a critical instance of Vietnam War reaction, and that I was shouting at the television in my frustration, my anger. And my wife, not at all gently, told me I was the worst kind of hypocrite. And retreating from her in a short period, I realized I was a hypocrite. I identified my education was as a progressive, and that I thought human rights were very important, that good governance was very important, and some I was still the true believer from my patriotic religious young adulthood. The watershed of 1970, which is in many ways a social watershed, an economic watershed, an ecological watershed, that the world since 1970, which was a peak of the American Empire post-World War II, and that in the American imperial adventure, misadventure, we call Vietnam, including the neighboring nations of Cambodia, and that in the post-1970 period, the American standard of living has stagnated. The middle class has shrunk. That homeless, the widespread phenomenon of anxiety and depression has grown, and I observe that the last 50 years post-1970 have been a decline of the American Empire, and we are just about to celebrate our 250th anniversary, and we shall see as to what is our look at the future.
So after this sort of watershed moment of realizing hypocrisy in your life, working for an oil company and at the same time being somewhat disgusted with the current state of politics and economics, you made a real change and headed to the other coast and led another life. You want to tell us a little bit about that period?
That was, in some ways of telling, a radicalization, or another relatively new word concept, desocialization. And desocialization, using this word concept, is a realization that the only way to take control of our lives, to return more power to our local environment, to inspire one another to local levels of creative desocialization, creative unplugging from the corporate controls over our life, the corporate and government controls, the surveillance, and the long list we might recite, that it is a time for local empowerment, and that was true back in 1970, 71, 72 in the Bay Area, California, that the corporate control over government, over the marketplace, over employment, and the whole corporate structure that I'm someone who thinks a lot about democracy and its characteristics at a time when there's so much agreement that democracy is threatened. And democracy begins at home, that we are in a period, I have been reading recently, of bioregional emphasis and activism, which is, of course, a place-centeredness where is our watershed reality? What are the characteristics of our soil? What is the geology of our place? And the bioregional movement is a complex set of ideas merging ecological and social and economic. In fact, I have been saying for about 30 years now, economics must equal ecologics. And of course, that is a hope and a prayer as I speak it, because economics is destroying ecologics, and that we must, in locally empowering, becoming more democratic and socially adept with one another, co-inspiring, co-creating a more local power over both the corporate and the governmental, especially the federal government. It is a truth to contemplate. Over my Wisconsin lifetime, beginning in 1941, that the state of Wisconsin has given more to the federal government than it has taken. That is a rare status for the state of Wisconsin and others like neighboring Minnesota, where that is also true. And so that thinking in a bioregional way, how can we strengthen one another in our collective lives and betterment of our collective reality?
So at some point, after having this bioregional realization, you moved back to the Midwest and particularly to the Driftless region. I believe you first settled around Dell. Is that correct?
It is correct, Eddie. We came to Wisconsin, back to Wisconsin, in 1975, exactly 50 years ago as we are speaking. It was a definite back-to-the-land consciousness motivating me, and like-minded folks who purchased a collective farm together just north of Dell, as you mentioned. The idea was collective ownership, collective living together, and we were a very strong cooperative in the agreements at that Upper Wooster farm north of Dell. Out of that experience came connections with the Kickapoo Stove Works, with Passages, the program for victims of domestic violence in Richland Center, and then to forming Crop Cooperative Organic Valley.
And that story of the forming of Organic Valley will be the subject of the next question after our break. You're listening to Conversations on WDRT. I'm speaking with Mr. Jerome McGeorge. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Conversations on WDRT. My guest this morning is Mr. Jerome McGeorge, one of the principal founders of Organic Valley, an astrologer, a great-grandfather, and an all-around sweet guy. Jerome, you were explaining the early days of forming the cooperative known as CROP, or Organic Valley. How did that all come about from your point of view?
It came about with a primary motivation to come to the aid of family farms at a time, at an extreme, there were suicides before and after farm auctions. It was a time of failing family farms that had really began in the 1950s, but by the late 1980s was at crisis stage. That the motivation to aid family farms led to the concept of organic agriculture, organic food. And that organic food, for reasons of its natural purity, would be able to earn a premium, which would be an aid, if not a lifeline, to failing family farms. In the coming together of the co-op in 1988, the first emphasis was on growing vegetables, and Wisconsin has a very rich history of growing vegetables and some apple orchards, and that the idea, if we could earn an organic premium for fruit and vegetables, we could definitely enhance farm incomes. The final thought in our thinking, after realizing organic agriculture, and I need to emphasize, in 1988, the word organic had almost no meaning. It had almost no meaning among the farmers of America or other parts of the world. And there was only one corporation, Cascadian, that had organic food in its advertising and offerings. So the idea, which the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture and the University of Wisconsin School of Agriculture both mocked our intentions as we tried to join in discussions of an organic premium for family farms. The third piece of the crop cooperative mission became our insistence on organizing a cooperative. And it could not be a corporation. Corporations had too much baggage as in terms of the corporate food and agricultural interest, and corporations in general corporations in the last couple hundred years of what we can call the Industrial Revolution have been murdering the environment, and that there is a great amount of ecological damage that is ongoing, and the organic movement is a slow-growing antidote to corporate food that has become dangerous. So that the Organic Valley story is a triple mission to family farms, to the organic movement worldwide, and to the cooperative movement also worldwide, where from headquarters nearby in Lafarge and Cashton, we engage the world, including, interestingly, a big customer of ours is the Pentagon, and they buy a lot of Organic Valley products to distribute at military installations around the world. We didn't see that coming in the bigger picture, but also it is a tribute to Organic Valley that the Pentagon recognizes the market demand among military families worldwide. We also have allies Australia, New Zealand, allies in China, allies in Central America and South America, and that we represent an attempt to make the world a better place for better food, for better health for all of us. That Organic Valley is now in 40-some states. It's in all 50 states as far as marketing, and it still is rooted here in the Driftless region with headquarters at both Lafarge and Cashton. That the Organic Valley story is the only cooperative that is involved in the international collaboration of our triple mission. That the co-op is now born in 1988 at approximately 38 years of duration, and we have just had a most wonderful 2025, and the cooperative, the enterprise known to the world as Organic Valley, is thriving.
It is an amazing story, and definitely one of the key industries in this area. As you were talking about the triple mission of saving family farms, promoting organic agriculture, and most importantly, promoting the idea of cooperatives. At that point in 1988, as you said, organics was almost unheard of. The concept of a cooperative is a long-standing concept in at least U.S. history with, you know, from its founding, we've had waves of these cooperative movements that have come and gone, or maybe we should say come and have been taken down by the industries that they're trying to compete against. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of cooperatives in this country and the ideology behind them and what they mean as opposed to a traditional corporation?
Interesting to the predominantly Wisconsin and maybe a few Minnesotans in the audience, and we have been talking bioregional consciousness, that the cooperative movement at 1970, a watershed year I was speaking about recently, that at 1970, 70% of all the cooperatives in the United States, including a lot of food marketing, retail marketing cooperatives, but 70% of all the co-ops in America were in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and that a tribute to the Scandinavian, German, North European influence, where cooperative movement was imported to this part of the upper Midwest by those Scandinavian, North European folks who found Wisconsin, Minnesota so like their homeland, and that they bequeathed us a progressive, cooperative inheritance. Now, Wisconsin and Minnesota do not any longer have 70% of all American co-ops, but obviously we are an historically most developed part of the co-op movement in America, with close ties, including Organic Valley, close ties to organic agriculture in Europe, as well as Asia and Australia, New Zealand, as I mentioned, that some, it is important in Organic Valley thinking, in my thinking, that sharing is better than having, that cooperating is better than competing, and that we want an ethic of citizens self-motivated, citizens responsible as individual, freely associating with one another in helpful and harmonious ways, that some, the saving of our democracy is this similar attitude of cooperating, of sharing. And we live in a culture that emphasizes having and competing, and consider that, as I know so well from my beloved Iroquois Confederacy researches and understandings, that the Iroquois created, and we think maybe 800 years ago, when the peacemaker and the beginning of the Confederacy was born out of warring nations, and the harmful treatment of human beings transforming into paths of cooperation, into paths of harmony, into, above all, the path of peace, that we are nonviolent with one another, and we have an ethic like the Confederacy of nonviolent behavior, that we do mean to co-inspire and co-create in this peaceful and harmonious environment, and we, in the spirit of cooperation, in the spirit of cooperatives, we realize our mutual aid for one another, that we are stronger when we are more together, and we are an extreme of individualized behavior, as I observe the situation in the American culture today, that we have too much violence in our culture, too much standing military, too much police power, and that we need not an emphasis on violence, but an emphasis on peace. Not an emphasis on conflict, but an emphasis on harmony. And over the centuries of the Iroquois Confederacy, it is worth emphasizing. They went hundreds of years, no jails, no standing military, no elements of coercion, and that it is a matter of right intention and right thinking that we begin again to create cultures that are in a primary emphasis on peaceful, nonviolent behavior and creating harmonious working conditions for the work that needs to be done. The cooperative movement will be an option that we have currently, and that the corporate model, just think of it, with especially the giant multinational corporations with powerful executive, that the modern corporate CEO is an empowered dictator who can tell his people how to dress, what they can talk about, what are the rules of their work behavior, and indeed, what is their compensation. That the cooperative model is a model for a better humanity. The corporate model is for a more profit driven to the few, to the exclusion of the many.
You mentioned this idea of bioregionalism, and I know that's been important for you throughout your life. When did you first sort of grasp that concept, and how do you see it influencing this area? We have a very unique and very well-defined bioregion here, both in the Driftless bioregion, this large unglaciated ancient land we live on, but also in the Great Lakes themselves. How do you see this vision of bioregionalism helping to evolve us into the future?
Eddie, I have a big smile remembering way back at the first year of WDRT going on the air, and you and I were part of a four-part series on bioregional thinking. Mm. Bioregional thinking, as I was starting to say earlier, is a place-centeredness. All of us, and where we call home is a very shaping, a very strong beginning with ecological consciousness. And so bioregionalism, some to emphasize the two great tasks that each one of us as newborns is challenged with. And the first task that we all are challenged with is our relationship to the living creation, our relationship to all other life, what we call nature, and that how do we become deeper acquainted, deeper rooted in our place, or less so, But bioregional thinking begins with place-centeredness. And of course, here in the paradise of the Driftless, the world for our home place is forest. If you take an arc of about 20 miles from here at WDRT headquarters, where I am speaking from, and that in an approximate 20-mile radius where the broadcast can be picked up, some places longer, and of course, this is very geologically challenging Driftless area where the farms must be small. We do not have the extensive agriculture of the Great Plains immediately south in Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, and that in this Driftless area, perhaps two-thirds and perhaps more of our WDRT radius zone is forest, and that it is the forest which we have a deep responsibility for its health, for the good air that all these trees help us to, for the sacred waters of this bioregion, that we might, in bioregional thinking, as far as a broader expanse, consider the states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, which on the west, the origin of the Mississippi, Missouri, Ohio River watershed, the magnificent riverine heart of America, and that to the north of our sacred waters bioregion, as we have playfully named it, is Lake Superior, and then Lake Michigan dividing the states of Michigan and Wisconsin. Further on the east, bordered by Lake Huron, and yet the southern boundary of all of these three states is the artificial straight line drawn by cartographic experts, that is, map makers. And the world, when we think of it as from bioregional perspective, is irrationally, in a major irrational pattern of nation states, of an incredible range of population and territorial expanse, and that nation states often cluster more than one bioregional reality or violate bioregional reality, and that we must, if we are going to be stewards of our environment in all the sense that we are growing into ecological responsibility, and as I mentioned earlier, transforming our economics into ecological harmonious, that we can no longer not consider the economic impact on our ecological reality. And so bioregionalism, then, if we all have the major life challenge, what are we as natural beings in the living creation? A second challenge each of us is born into is the world of human affairs.
And we'll take a second break quickly, and we'll come back and continue on that exploration. This is Conversations on WDRT. I'm Eddie Nix, and I'm speaking today with Jerome McGeorge. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Conversations on WDRT. My name is Eddie Nix, and I'm speaking today with Jerome McGeorge. Jerome, you were just discussing bioregionalism, which brings into the scope of things the environment, and with it, the feminine. You wanted to discuss the idea of ecofeminism and how that has a major place in your life.
Indeed. A major place in my life, and a growing realization over my last 40 years and some the introduction of Native American culture, Native American history, and adventures with Native American leaders. And, of course, I was mentioning the Iroquois Confederacy, where in the purest democracy that we know of, everyone was equal, and that the women in Iroquois country were organized in clan mother circles. And the Iroquois Confederacy has 50 traditional chiefs among scattered over the six nations of the Iroquois, that in those chieftainships, if a chief dies, the circle of clan mothers attached to that chieftainship names the new chief. Critically, the women can also recall a chief, and that if in local or national affairs, the women, which so influenced the founding fathers of America, had a veto power over anything the men in protocol, in assembly, in their council fire style, might decide, that it was an incredibly balanced society with women completely in control of their sexuality and reproduction. So the ecofeminist, which is also a strong harmony with bioregionalism, but consider that at the heart of ecofeminism, and eco is ecological and feminist, that is the insight that many psychologists have developed, and for me, most brilliantly by Carl Jung, the animus theory, that for all males in their incarnation in male identity need to develop their inner feminine, that male energy is animus, and that the I Ching, the yin-yang balance, that men develop their inner feminine, women develop their inner masculine, and so the result is a much superior equality of gender reality so that I am a whole human being, not a gender specialist as either a female or a male. That ecofeminism, what anthropologists have also called matrifocal society, is a society that recognizes the essential parenting of mothers. One way to understand the difference in sexual reproduction between men and women is that the sperm cell that men produce is, in a comparison of mass, biomass, 1/4,000th of an egg cell, a unified egg cell. So that the contribution of men to parenting is essentially what we call the DNA package, the generic genetic package of humanity, which of course is different in each sperm cell and each egg cell, but that the egg cell is so much more complex as well as so much more mass, and that the reality of human parenting is so much this contrast of the male sperm and the female egg in their relative contributions. So that, especially for males, to realize their feminine, their anima consciousness, is a definite necessity for wholeness at the level of our humanity. And so ecofeminism and bioregionalism is, in a matrifocal way of speaking, what we call Earth Mother, and all the reasons why we identify with Mother as Earth. And that my astrology is deeply informed by the mantra, as above, so below. As below, so above.
And let's look at that astrology. You are known in the community as an astrologer, probably more than anything. And I know you've spent the majority of your life studying this most esoteric subject. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that journey, the importance, in your opinion, of astrology and astrological understandings, and where you feel we sit right now as humanity looking through the lens of astrology? And I think we have about 4 minutes left.
Well, 4 minutes, it can be a long time. And Eddie, I want to respond in a stream of consciousness from the ecofeminism that there is a renaissance of astrology, perhaps as long as this 21st century, but it is notable that this renaissance of astrology is identified as so many younger women becoming astrologers. And it is certainly a much more feminine tide than it is young masculine. And there are some wonderful male astrologers, but the world of astrology is, in one way of understanding, that each of us as above, so below, is a solar system, that within me there is a sun consciousness, a sun reality, but also a lunar reality. And to distinguish among those two most important astrological symbols, that the sun is much more what we call our soul and our soul song and our karmic inheritance, and that it is important in my thinking, and it cannot be stated with certainty, but I believe, I have a deep faith in reincarnation. I also think, in harmony with that statement, that the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic peoples believe, at least some, that we only have one life to live, and so it is taught. I disagree and can point to the reality that in China and India, far and away the two largest nations on earth, reincarnation is alive and well. Here in America, 30 to 40% of Americans, when polled, respond that they can see or allow for reincarnation, and yet also are under the dominant teaching of our particular culture, in distinction from China or India or Indonesia, another large nation, that we do have many lives to live, and that in my own consciousness, I have met and have been introduced to the idea that my chart shows that I am a reincarnate astrologer, and that the Vedic philosophy, the Vedic astrological tradition, has much more to teach about reincarnation astrology than anything in the Western world. That astrology is a science of first knowing self, and not just the sun and the moon, but our whole spectrum of planets that each of us represents, that consider that you are a solar system in your being, and that you are a magical person in a deeper understanding of self.
Jerome, I wish we could talk for hours and hours about this, but we're at the end of our time. This has been Conversations. I've been speaking with Jerome McGeorge, and it's been a wonderful pleasure. Merry Christmas.